This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Monday, June 7th. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, while the Israeli military's bombing of Gaza may have paused, peace activists in Denver continue to call for accountability to tie military funding to international human rights standards. Since the 1960s, access to birth control has been responsible for one-third of women's wage gains. But six decades later, the threat to women's reproductive rights is at an all-time high. That story coming up. Annual rankings for bike-friendly cities are out. We'll check out where Boulder landed and why. Finally, we'll get a preview of this afternoon's Metro show airing at 3 p.m. when Miriam Schiff examines the pandemic that has plagued the world since the 1980s and the importance of ending the stigma of AIDS. At the bottom of the hour, we'll hear the BBC headlines and the latest Jim Hightower commentary. Then it's a public affair. Today, Frank Dubofsky talks with State Representative Judy Amabile about some of the bills she's been working on during the 2021 legislative session. Amabile represents House District 13, which includes the west side of Boulder and western Boulder County. Then comes Counterspin at 9 a.m., a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. But first, a look at the headlines with KGNU's Jamie Sudler.
Today, Pride Week will be launched by Out Boulder County, which is asking all community members, including LGBTQ and others, to hang flags from their homes, cars, and businesses. The organization said in a statement this weekend that for the first time, the city of Louisville and Boulder's 29th Street Mall have made an outward effort to celebrate the LGBTQ community. But there has been vandalism. Out Boulder says that in Louisville, the Pride flags were removed and a Confederate flag was planted. And in Boulder, a Pride banner was cut in half and another stolen. Out Boulder is now asking for a show of flags to outnumber those who are invested in keeping the community as second-class citizens. A bill that would grant farm workers the right to join labor unions won preliminary approval by the State House of Representatives on Friday after debate that stretched for more than 5 hours. Senate Bill 87 intends to afford farm workers the same protections available to other workers, such as the right to strike and bargain collectively. Colorado Politics reports that the bill would also require minimum wage and overtime pay and allow agricultural workers to seek protection in the courts from retaliation or based on other complaints. The bill is backed by legal advocates and unions, but has been opposed by every major agricultural organization in the state, as well as numerous business groups. The measure will be up for a final vote in the House, and if approved, will have to head back to the Senate for a review of amendments. The first $1 million winner of the Colorado COVID-19 vaccine sweepstakes was announced on Friday. Sally Sliger from Mead was randomly selected from more than 3 million Coloradans who have received at least one dose of coronavirus vaccine. Four more people will get the prize. In total, the Colorado Comeback Cash Program comprises $6.25 million. It also includes 25 drawings to award $50,000 college scholarships to kids 12 to 17 years old. The money comes from federal dollars meant to help states promoting their vaccination campaigns. The Colorado Sun reports that after peaking in late March and early April, the pace of vaccinations in Colorado has declined. A little over 140,000 doses of vaccine were administered last week in Colorado. At the peak, Colorado health care providers administered more than 400,000 doses a week. Colorado Governor Jared Polis has expressed dismay that more people have not gotten vaccinated, noting that COVID-19 case rates are generally highest in counties where vaccination rates are the lowest. Meanwhile, coronavirus cases and hospitalizations are rising in Mesa County on the West Slope. The Denver Post reports that the community is struggling with widespread transmission of a highly contagious variant and lagging vaccination rates. Close to 100% of that county's hospital beds were filled with patients on Friday. Most of the hospitalizations are occurring among unvaccinated residents, although at least one healthcare system said it is also treating more patients with non-COVID injuries. Boulder County District Attorney Michael Doherty has announced that murder charges have been filed against a man in the disappearance of a woman more than 3 years ago. Rita Gutierrez Garcia was last seen during a night out in Longmont in March 2018 when she celebrated St. Patrick's Day with friends and family. Juan Jose Figueroa Jr. was indicted by a Boulder County grand jury on various charges in the incident. While no body has been recovered, police have said that they presume Gutierrez Garcia is dead. Doherty said a number of factors contributed to the lack of charges for 3 years, with the significant issue being that Gutierrez Garcia's body has yet to be found. Mostly sunny skies today with a high around 90 and a slight chance of showers this afternoon. Tomorrow, sunny with highs in the low 90s. Right now, it's about 64 in Boulder and Fort Collins and 72 already in Denver. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
The Israeli military's bombing of Gaza has paused for now, as has the intensity of the outcry in opposition to it. Peace activists in Denver continue to mobilize around the issue, most recently as over the weekend. They're calling for an end to forced displacement of Palestinians and for the application of accountability mechanisms for the billions of dollars of aid the U.S. supplies to the Israeli military every year. KGNU's Dave Ashton sends this audio from Denver.
My name is Lillian House. I'm an organizer with the Party for Socialism and Liberation. This is week 5 of the protests in Denver for Palestine, and we're out here even after the ceasefire because we know that we have to really build a movement, and that's what we're here to do if we want to see the end to apartheid and the genocide that is going on over in Palestine.
So the ceasefire is not the end?
No, the ceasefire is not the end. No, we've seen so many iterations of just the intensification of the conflict there where it becomes, you know, an all-out war, an all-out assault. But the daily lives of Palestinians, the reality for so many millions of Palestinians in refugee camps, you know, the fact that so many people cannot return to their homes, none of that is acceptable. And that is the daily reality. That's normal and that's not acceptable to us. In the United States, we get such a skewed picture of what's happening on the ground, and we're told a lot of times in particular that the situation is just far too complex to understand. But when you actually talk to people about the reality that this is an occupation, this is apartheid, like in South Africa, people really come to understand, okay, no, this is a clear issue. I'm on the side of the freedom of people to, you know, live in their homes without being pushed out, to, you know, have access to water and electricity and the basic essentials of life, and that's what's being denied to Palestinians. So it really is that simple, but yeah, it's foreign to a lot of people in the United States.
Rima Wadan, Colorado Palestine Club.
You've been doing this work for a long time.
A long time, 40 years. So 4 decades that we've been here. I have pictures at the Capitol steps when I was, I believe I was 4 years old then. So I've been here for a long time trying to raise awareness about the Palestinian situation.
This is a particularly intense time. Do you feel like something has increased or changed for the efforts that you're doing to raise awareness?
Definitely. I think our active campaigning, calling our senators, our local state representatives, and our national representatives has sparked a shift in dynamic where they hear us. Thousands of calls in, letter writing campaigns into our officials have shifted the arrow in favor of Palestinian rights, because we're out here campaigning for just basic rights, the rights for Palestinians to survive, to be able to have basic human needs, rights to water, access to food and medicine, which is not happening under the Israeli government. So we are here just trying to get those basic needs to the Palestinians in Palestine.
What do you feel like are some of the basic misconceptions that you're working to change?
Misconceptions are probably surrounding the role of Hamas. I'm not a proponent for them, but every time we start discussions about basic Palestinian rights, it always shifts to, well, Hamas is doing this. Well, we're here saying this is not just a Hamas-led effort. This is an ongoing campaign against the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians that live in Palestine. So to keep using Hamas as a smokescreen is not acceptable anymore. People are dying. Children are malnutrition. They're not getting COVID tested. Their only center in Gaza Strip has been bombed during their 11-day campaign. the Palestinians have a right to defend themselves. They have a right to self-determination, and they have a right to live. And so that's what we're here to do, is to be able to grant those basic rights to them, to be able to shed the awareness of how people shouldn't be ostracizing the Palestinians or calling any supporter of the Palestinian community an anti-Semite, because we're here just saying Palestinians just deserve a right to live, period. I would call upon everybody to understand that the struggles of any oppressed people, whether you're a Latino, Black, Malaysian, or any of the governments struggling and feeling that they're under an oppressed government, this is their struggle. So it's not just the Palestinian struggle, but it's the struggle of any oppressed people that are trying to have a democratic voice to say that, you know, we have a right to exist. And so there's always interconnections and cross intersections between different communities, whether it's climate change, anti-war campaigns. All of us have that voice, and we are all fighting for the same cause. And so to have all those groups unite with us is amazing to see. The diversity in our crowds is great, because we all understand it's a human struggle, and we all have that right to speak up against any type of blatant disregard for human life, especially when it's using U.S. taxpayer money to commit these atrocities. And as a U.S. citizen, I am not going to be in favor of my government sending $3.8 billion to the Israeli government to commit war atrocities against the Palestinians, to commit child detention, and to be able to say that it is okay when it is not. When we have homeless people in Denver community, the homeless community has exploded. We can use that money here in the United States. If we're going to be all about America, bring it back here. Stop supporting a war machine and stop supporting the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people.
From the river to the sea! Palestine will be free!
The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a Mississippi abortion case that opponents of the medical procedure hope will dramatically alter nearly 50 years of rulings on abortion rights by overturning Roe v. Wade. KGNU's Roz Brown has more on a new study that shows how important reproductive health care has been to women's paychecks and their state's economies.
Access to birth control has actually been responsible for like a third of women's wage gains since the 1960s.
That's Alexis McGill-Johnson, president and CEO of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America.
You know, Planned Parenthood was built on the premise that if you control your own body, you can control your own future. And I do think that a lot of what we have been focused on from a reproductive health standpoint is what are some of the tools that we need to imagine freedom? And we know that economic security just has a direct impact on healthcare access. Because if you can't access health insurance or affordable health care, people will forego the care that they need.
An online tool created by the Institute for Women's Policy Research assessed the financial impacts of reproductive health restrictions at the state level. Data from the tool shows that if all state-level abortion restrictions were eliminated, thousands more women would enter the workforce.
You know, we know at the national level, the state-level abortion restrictions cost $105 billion per year, right, by reducing labor force participation and earnings. If all the state-level abortion restrictions were eliminated, 500,000 women would enter the workforce, earning $3 billion. Some of the same states where we're seeing the most extreme restrictions have the most to gain, states like Arkansas, Missouri, Mississippi.
On May 17th, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear arguments challenging a Mississippi law that bans most abortions after 15 weeks. It's a case, Johnson says, strikes at the heart of Roe v. Wade, the 1973 Supreme Court ruling that made abortion legal. She says a ruling upholding the Mississippi law would put women at risk in states where abortions could be banned.
And the way in which they're taking it up is literally a challenge that goes to the very heart of Roe, which we already know is, you know, what our reproductive justice colleagues call the floor at best. But the willingness to undo 50 years of precedent, there's always been a bright line that pre-viability politicians don't decide, that we can decide, really thinking about the impact now for what could happen to upwards of 25 million women of reproductive age living in states where it could be banned.
While Colorado is among the states with the least restrictive abortion access in the nation, more than 500 bills restricting or banning the procedure have been introduced across 46 states in the past few years. That includes Colorado, where voters shot down a ballot measure last year called Proposition 115 that sought to ban abortions after 22 weeks of gestation. The ballot question failed by a margin of 60% to 40%. But supporters said they'll be back in an attempt to move the needle in a future election.
And it's happening at a time when we also know that we've had record highs of support for access to abortion. So the fact that all of this is happening against the majority of public opinion in every single state, not just national public opinion, but literally every single state, there is a majority of Americans who believe that they believe that Roe should be the law of the land. It really just highlights the kind of starkness of, again, who is making these decisions and then thinking differently about, like, what is the impact going to be on not having that access.
At the same time, the number of women receiving financial help from a Colorado fund that pays for abortions is climbing as other states continue to enact restrictions and bans. The Colorado Sun reports that fund, managed by the nonprofit group Cobalt, helped 20 times as many women last year compared with 4 years ago, spending $204,000 to help pay for abortions and travel compared with less than $6,000 in 2017. Since COVID struck the U.S., Johnson says Planned Parenthood is looking at new ways to protect reproductive rights for women.
I think we also need to do more on expanding access through things like telehealth, making sure that we are pushing to expand as much access as possible in states that are favorable so that we really are demonstrating the kind of stark disparity. We need to be pushing on things aligning with businesses around issues like broadband that limit that access to healthcare. But I think it's ultimately part of what we have to do collectively is work together in these at these intersections, and I think keeping them stronger than coalitions, which come together and disband, but really keeping an intersectional group together that takes all of this on, including democracy reform, so that we are able to make sure that we are connecting the dots between the same states that are having these horrific restrictions on access to abortion are also the same states that are suppressing the vote. They're the same states that are attacking trans rights. And that, I think, how we show up authentically in each state, because it is going to be a state-by-state work to really focus on state constitutions. At some point, it's going to require that kind of connection and infrastructure to work together.
While Roe versus Wade has been the law of the land, the Supreme Court now includes three justices appointed by President Donald Trump, resulting in a 6-3 conservative majority, which means opponents feel this is their best chance for making abortions illegal in most states. For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
The cycling nonprofit People for Bikes has released its new national and international rankings for bike-friendly cities. I spoke with Kyle Wagenschutz, Vice President of Local Innovation at People for Bikes.
This is now our fourth year of releasing city ratings, where we assess the quality, connectivity, and conditions that make cities great for bicycling. And this year, we've included 660 U.S. cities, and then also for the first time, more than 100 international cities from about 11 different countries around the world. And you know, that provides a lot of context for any of the cities in the ratings to understand where your city stacks up in terms of the progress that it's making to make bicycling more fun, more efficient, more safe. No surprise, because of the inclusion of some Western European countries this year, our top spots overall are dominated by communities in the Netherlands and other parts of Europe who are known, pretty well known for their advanced positions on bikeability.
Okay, so what makes the Netherlands so great for bikes?
Well, one of the primary conditions that we're looking for in the city ratings is we're looking for communities that have safe, connected, comfortable bicycle networks. And that's the system of trails and bike lanes and pathways that make bicycling really convenient. We're looking for the same kind of convenience and safety as a person would drive their car. And the communities from the Netherlands that rank top in the top spots, Utrecht, Zwolle, Groningen, these are places that have been making investments in their bicycle infrastructure since the 1960s and 70s. It's been a slow, gradual, incremental progress for those communities, but they've now reached a level of maturity, 50 years later, where getting onto a bicycle is just a commonplace activity that happens in those communities. Now, if I think about directly, some direct comparisons to Boulder here, where we're based, Zwolle and Groningen in the Netherlands offer a really great comparison, both from a city size and also from the orientation to major universities.
Let's zoom in on Boulder, and where is it ranked and why?
Yeah, so Boulder's score was 65 out of 100 points. That puts them really near the top, both in the U.S. and globally. In fact, globally, Boulder's score ranked number 22 out of all 770 cities that we rated. Here in the U.S., you know, we categorize the scorings based on the size of the cities, and so of mid-sized cities, Boulder is number 6. And that's been a consistent theme with Boulder for the last 4 years in our system. We have seen continuous progress and growth being made here locally, and also a consistent place, you know, near the top of our list. I would suggest that, you know, the reason that Boulder's had this level of consistency is because of the breadth and connectivity of the network that it does have today. It is wildly above average for any U.S. city. And I think, you know, what's easy to forget as we sort of, you know, live and work here and sort of see things every day that we'd love to see improved, you know, I think what City Ratings offers is an opportunity for, you know, one time a year for everyone locally to sort of take a step back, applaud the success and achievements that are being made. Also, though, you know, with this benchmark of communities in the Netherlands and elsewhere around the world, for us to sort of say, like, wow, you know, we're doing pretty well, but we could be better. And here's some models for us to actually look at.
And I think that anybody who's been to the Netherlands can say, okay, yeah, fair enough. But surely there are some people here in Boulder who are thinking, 6th out of all the mid-sized U.S. cities, we were robbed. What was it that kept Boulder behind the 5 cities in front of them?
I think, you know, one of the other factors that that the City Ratings looks at, other than the infrastructure and how well connected people are, is that we measure community perceptions of cycling. You know, it's really important for us not to just look at data, you know, in a spreadsheet and make an evaluation just based on numbers. You know, there's plenty of, you know, understanding out in the world that numbers themselves don't tell the full story. You need some additional context. And so we also survey people living, biking, working in each of the communities that we're evaluating. Boulder's no exception to that. And when I look at Boulder's score in terms of these community perceptions, there's one category that stands out to me as sort of needing some improvements, and it's the perception of safety, which is really interesting because I just told you that Boulder's network provides sort of for a pretty high level of safety. But I'm not sure that the community members living and working and biking here actually are feeling that. You know, their perception is that it's a pretty unsafe place to ride. And, you know, when I compared, you know, again, we're talking, you know, in the top 6 in mid-sized cities, we're looking sort of at some pretty marginal, you know, differences in points, 1 or 2 points here or there. And that, what that tells to me is that there are, you know, the network might be functioning at a very practical level in terms of safety and connectivity, but people don't feel totally comfortable getting out and riding on the trails in Boulder or riding in the bike lanes in Boulder. That could be a matter of marketing and messaging. It could also be a matter of having infrastructure that, you know, appears to be safer, looks safer, providing greater separation between bikes and cars. It could also be a real opportunity to sort of think about, you know, who doesn't perceive Boulder's sort of bike lanes to be safe. And I'd suggest that, you know, if we looked at specifically women and seniors as sort of target audiences for future improvements, that that we would begin to see some real change in that perception. There's some recent studies out that highlight the need specifically for women to feel comfortable riding in our communities as a predictor of cycling becoming safe for all users. And I think, you know, a city like Boulder, who's done a lot of the basic work, who's thinking about what's the next incremental step that we can do, would be about, you know, creating some real targeted programs that perhaps, you know, lean on the perceptions, experiences, and knowledge of women riding in the community as sort of a next phase of how to go about making the city better for biking.
Kyle Wagenschutz of People for Bikes, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, thank you, Shannon. It's a real pleasure.
On On today's Metro Show at 3 p.m., Miriam Schiff talks about the HIV/AIDS pandemic with Eli Bazan, co-founder of the Parasol Patrol. He has been living with the disease for 5 years and fighting the stigma and misinformation that has surrounded AIDS for decades.
Why was it important for you to talk about being HIV positive now as it was for Billy Porter and Jonathan Van Ness?
I think it really all comes down to the stigma. If we hide in the shadows and don't talk about it, and it continues to be that disease that only affects certain people in certain people's minds, then it is allowed to be pushed down and allowed to be forgotten again. Of course, I wasn't ready to scream it from the rooftops when I was first diagnosed. It took some time. It took probably a good year or two of being on medication, of learning what I was dealing with and becoming personally okay with that before I was able to actually talk about it in more of a public setting.
Listen to more at 3 p.m. today on KGNU's Metro Show with Miriam Schiff. Thank you for joining us on today's Monday Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young.